Well, it's certainly been a while. I'm Georgie Crawford. This is the Good Glow Podcast. Thank you for tuning in. You know, I believe we all have a story, and by sharing our stories, we can help and inspire each other on this journey through life. This season of the Good Glow Podcast is brought to you with thanks to Promise Gluten Free, a family business founded in the foothills of the Donegal Mountains on the Wild Atlantic Way. Promise Gluten Free products are designed to help you enjoy your life the way you want to, without compromising on taste or quality. High in fiber with soft texture, it's not just one size fits all. The Promise Gluten Free range includes everything from your everyday white loaf to fluffy brioche cakes and muffins, flatbreads, and my personal favourite, the sourdough rustic seed. Why not try it today? Available in Dunn Stores, Super Value, and Tesco, or head over to promisegluten-free.ie for more. Welcome back to The Good Glow. It's been a while since I've said that. I am so happy to be here. I'm so happy to be back every Sunday. And I have an amazing season coming your way. Wherever you are in the world, thank you for tuning in. And I really, really hope you're going to enjoy this episode. So I've had so much going on over the last couple of months. I will fill you in on everything. And I also have something really exciting to announce on Tuesday. So keep an eye out on Instagram for that. The January refresh is starting tomorrow. You can join at any point in January. And for 14 days, I'm going to be your coach. It's all about making 2023 the year we take steps forward. So instead of revolving year after year, can we take steps to evolve? Can we get around to doing all of those things that we promise ourselves we can do? So this is how we can make progress in our professional and our personal lives. And there are so many simple tools on this course in how you can take realistic steps forward and start living that life you've been waiting to. All you need is 10 minutes a day. I email you every morning with that day's session. You can do it in your own time. Just 10 minutes. And we got so many amazing reviews after our last course. So I really hope you're going to enjoy this one. Head over to thegoodglow.ie to sign up and join the hundreds of people doing this course. Now, on to today's episode, probably one of the most special episodes of The Good Glow that I've ever recorded. I spent the last 3 months with one thing on my mind: get PJ Gallagher on The Good Glow somehow. And I just want to say a massive thank you to Stephanie Preisner, who helped make this happen today. Thank you to PJ for your time. I know you've been through such a rough road. A stand-up comedian, loved by thousands, a breakfast show on Radio Nova with Jim McCabe. PJ revealed last year that he spent 11 weeks at St. Patrick's Hospital after a breakdown. Today, he tells me his story in such a beautiful way, but also in such a funny way, because he has such a magic way about him and he's never lost his humour, and his story is just incredibly inspiring. Pia, this week, keeps asking me to play Katy Perry Roar in the car, and I've been looking at her in the rearview mirror and she is screaming the lyrics and she's like, "You're gonna hear me roar." And I was looking at her this week just thinking, I hope she always uses that voice. And if you're feeling low, please use your voice. Tell someone, shout it from the rooftops. If you need help, if you need support, it is there. And I'm gonna ask you a favor now, and I've never asked this before. Please put this podcast into your WhatsApp groups. People need to hear it. Please send this podcast to the men in your life, even the ones that you don't think you have to worry about. Send it to your friends, send it to your family, because PJ's message needs to be heard. We need to use our voices. I've included helplines in the show notes. I'm going to give a trigger warning as well. PJ speaks about his low moments. And something interesting that I really want you to listen out for in this podcast, PJ speaks about his rock bottom moment, you know, that moment that he really feared. But watch out for what he says happens afterwards. Everything in his life got better from that moment as soon as he articulated how he was feeling and as soon as he asked for help. We need to remember that, yes, we may hit our rock bottom, but there is an opportunity in a rock bottom to rise. And that's exactly what happened to PJ. One day at a time, and then the next day, and then the next. I'm so glad you've joined me on the Good Glow, PJ. I think we're going to have an amazing conversation. I've been watching everything you've done over the last while, and it's such important work. How are you?
Oh, no, well, I'm okay. I mean, it's been, I'm pretty good, to be honest, you know. It's just been such a crazy 12 months, you know. Like this time last year, I was in hospital. I was in St. Pat's this time last year. I thought I was going to be out at that stage, but they told, you know, I honestly thought I was going in for 4 weeks, and they said it ended up being 11 weeks. And then I came out and I was getting everything together, and my ma was more ill, and she just died like 2 months ago. And then, you know, my ex, who's still like one of my best mates, then, you know, her mother just died like a week ago. So it's just been such a crazy, tumultuous sort of 12 months. But in a weird way, it couldn't have happened at a better time, because I'm so equipped to deal with these things happening now that like I never was before, you know. So how am I? Yeah, I mean, it's been crazy. It's been better, but I'm good, you know. I'm feeling pretty good. I'm feeling well, you know. I'm feeling like I'm able for everything. So to be able to even say that is kind of great, you know.
Yeah, and it's, I think the thing when anyone is suffering, it just goes to show that we never know what's going on in people's lives. And you've always been the funny guy, you know, the person everyone wants to be around, tuning into you on the radio. Like, what was life like for you when you were suffering?
Oh, God. I mean, it was such a, like, it was such a slow decline at the start, and then it kind of went, and then there was one moment where everything fell down. So it was hard to, it's really hard to explain, because initially, like, I started not feeling myself, and, you know, because I'm a bloke and I'm my age, I think maybe like it'll get better, it'll be fine, just push on, you know, whatever happens, keep it to yourself, like you'll be all right, you know, the internal dialogue that everything's going to be fine. And then there was one day where I was like lying on my bed, and my partner just was saying, "You're not you. I don't know who this is. Like, I just don't recognize you anymore." And that was kind of the moment I said, "Okay, I'm not well." But from that point on, I went into another sort of stage of denial where it was like, "Okay, I'm not well. I just need to find the right medication. I need to find the right doctor. I need to be told what to do. I need all these things. If I can find those things, I'll be all right." And everybody was telling me, "You're much sicker than that. You know, you're like, this isn't a mental health thing. This is a mental illness thing." And, you know, the doctors were calling me then, like, then there was a point. I was with my ex. I was walking in Phoenix Park, and it was like the world fell down around me. I've been trying to, that's the one thing I wish I could articulate better. What happened at that point, you know, where we were just like walking, and then I can only describe it as a collapse. I just don't have the words to describe that, just this sudden feeling of just really not wanting to be alive anymore, like just feeling like the world is not a place for me to be. And from that moment on, every single thought in my head was trying to kill me. Like, that's the only way I can describe it. Like, every thought I had was trying to kill me. Every cell of my body was trying to kill me, you know, from that point on. And still, to me, the idea of someone finding out was worse than the idea of being dead, which is, when I think of it now, absolute craziness. You know, that's the only point where I can describe it as actually crazy, you know. But eventually I succumbed and went into the hospital, and so it was really tough, you know. And still going on the radio every day and trying to make people laugh, and that was making things worse, because I knew I wasn't able to do my job right. And to me, the only thing that mattered anymore was my job. It was an awful time. Like, there's really no other way to put it.
And when you say, like, people finding out, do you mean, like, your inner circle knew, but you didn't want anybody else to know? Or did you really feel like you were suffering alone?
Oh, honestly, anybody. You know, like, I was so embarrassed. Even my partner knew, you know. I guess for me, like, there was this, the mental health conversation is a great conversation when you're feeling mentally kind of healthy, you know. Yeah. It's a great conversation when you're feeling good, you know. And then you get to points where you go, oh, I'm not feeling really good. And, you know, then they say, well, reach out. And you go, okay, maybe I'll meet my friend for a pint, or I'll ask my friends to go for a walk, or I'll meet up with the local dog group, or I'll do these things. And it's good for your mental health. But, you know, when you're literally trying to stay alive with every breath, that conversation doesn't mean anything anymore. You know, that, the, you know, you need round the clock 24 hour care because you're a complete danger to yourself. And those conversations of get to the gym, eat better, those things don't mean anything. You're just too far gone. You know, they mean something now because I feel good and I want to keep staying good, but like, so, and the shame, so the mental health conversation just didn't feel relevant to me. I was so mentally ill, I thought I became ashamed of it. I was like, no one can find out, my work can't find out, like, I can't ever tell my job, I can't tell my friends, like, I was just so ashamed or embarrassed. And that was the hardest part for me, was just, you know, keeping the cover up. The cover up was so important, you know. I'd rather have died with the cover up than have told anyone at that time.
And what was the shame about that you were suffering, or that, you know, you are one of these people that have mental health problems? Or was it like, what was it that you were so afraid of people finding out about you?
I just think I had an idea in my head of what people perceived mental illness to be, you know, so it was okay to say I have a bit of anxiety or I have a bit of depression, but to say that you needed to be in hospital conjured up this image for me. I didn't know what hospital was going to look like, you know. I was like Nurse Ratchet and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and, you know, I thought, like, you go in there, you never come out the same, and, you know, it's life-changing to a degree that you'll never be able to look after yourself. I had this crazy idea that that's what that meant, and I just didn't want to be seen like that. I didn't want to be seen as being, you know, a needy, unable to look after themselves, complete basket case, you know. That's what it was for me. And in a way, that is what I was, you know. But when you say it to people, you realize nobody thinks like that except for the person who's sick, you know.
Yeah. And you speak all the time about all these amazing women that you were surrounded by.
Yeah.
Like Elaine, Stephanie Preisner, your mum. My husband, Jamie, he's always surrounded by feminine energy. So he's really close to his sister, his mum. He works at me all day, every day. In a way, did you feel like that was a blessing for you at the time?
Oh, Jesus, yeah. Like, absolutely, you know. My partner, Ash, and Stephanie Preisner, like, to have a friend as close as her, and Elaine, like, to still be so close to Elaine, and, like, that those three people were the three people I am closest to, were, you know, was unbelievable, you know, because my male friends, I would say to them, I'm not feeling great, and their reaction was, yeah, okay, well, we'll get out and do something. But getting out and doing something, like I was saying earlier, that's not really the answer. You know, the women in my life just didn't take no for an answer and didn't entertain my bullshit. Like, they were like, you need to go to the doctor, you need to get into hospital, you need to be doing more than you are doing. And, you know, I needed that push, and I needed that push for quite a long time. And I'm not being hard on the lads. The lads were brilliant, you know. But for example, the lads in the pub knew I was sick and in hospital and everything for months after I got out. And then I went and told them, listen, guys, I was in hospital. And they went, oh, yeah, we know. Not one person said anything. Like, not one person even asked. They were like, you know, don't bring it up, leave him alone, he might be embarrassed. Whereas the women in my life were like, get the fuck into hospital now. You know, just get in. And, like, they visited and they came in, they brought me food and washed my clothes and encouraged me and kept saying, you're going to get better, you're going to get better, you're going to get better. And, like, that was a big thing for me, you know. There is definitely a difference, you know. Lads just find it harder, you know. I think lads speak shoulder to shoulder, not face to face, and sometimes you need someone to look you right in the eyes and tell you what you need to do.
If there was a man in your life that came to you now and said, oh, you know, I'm feeling a bit down, what would you say? What do you say to them? Because like you're saying, it's not, it shouldn't be shoulder to shoulder. It needs to be face to face. Like, would you address it straight to them?
I think I would now. Yeah. Like, and now I'd be just, let's go to your GP, both of us, you know, if that's what you want, we'll go now, or let's go to the A&E now, both of us. I'll sit with you all day, you know, or we're going to sit down now and we're going to find you a psychiatrist and we're going to book it in and we're going to see each other every day until that happens. Or I'm going to make sure you get out of the house every day. My phone's going to be on. The ringer's going to be on. You can call me anytime. That literal action literally saved my life when Stephanie Prisner said it to me, you know. Yeah, you know, night and day, the no time is too early. Forget about time, you know, just, you know, and to constantly be, here's what I think you need, here's what I think you need, or here's the people you need to talk to. You know, I'm not professional, but I can do everything I can to try and push you in that direction. You know, that's all I can do, and that's all anyone can do, really.
So tell us about that night then when you arrived on Stephanie's doorstep at 4 a.m.
Well, it was my... Yeah, like that was the morning I woke up and I thought that was the day I like genuinely I thought this is the day I can't get through. This is today is the day. I just, you know, yeah, like it's weird when you're really sick, you wake up and you have, you probably had it when you were sick too, I imagine, like 1 second where you forget everything. And like you, 1 second, you have literally 1 second in the morning where you can't think of anything bad or anything good. You're just existing. It's this wonderful second that is all you, and then the whole world, you just remember what's happening and it knocks you so hard. And this day it hit me so hard. I was just like, I'm not going to make it through today.
Were you in work that day?
No, it was a weekend. It was a Saturday or Sunday, because I remember I was booked in to do some fitness class or something. And I woke up and just that feeling hit me harder than ever. And I thought, I'm not going to see the end of today. And that was the only way I had to console on me myself, was to say, I'm not going to see the end of the day. And I looked at my phone and there was a message from Stephanie saying, listen, no time is too early, no time is too late, pal. Love you. You know, I'm always here, whatever. And I rang her immediately and said, I've hit my limit. I can't do it anymore. And she was just like, get into your car, come see me now. And I got to her house and weirdly, she was like, how do you feel? And weirdly, the first thing was, I'm hungry. Like, it's just, I don't know what it is about. Some people get depressed and they can't eat. Like, it's literally all I can do. Like, yeah, I'm still trying to lose my depression weight, you know. And then she was like, right, we're going to go get you porridge. And we got into the car. And I remember, like, getting the porridge and sitting there. And when she sat back into the car with me, I felt so bad. I was physically shaking and trying to hug myself, you know, like falling in, almost into like the fetal position, but behind the driving wheel of the car. Like, I probably shouldn't have been driving at all, but I'm not sorry I did it, you know. And she put her hand on me, you know, and she's like, I've never seen you so bad, but she's like, right now all your needs are met. Right now all your needs are met. She kept saying it, you know. I was like, well, why do I feel so bad? I'm never going to get better. She was like, I promise you, this is it. Like, this is the bottom. Right now, all your needs are met. Like, and she was saying, you know, you're going to have to go to hospital. I was like, yeah, I know. And I made the call to the hospital. And then it was weird because that was the one thing I didn't want to do. And then all of a sudden they were like, yeah, there's like a 2 week wait. I was like, oh, Jesus, I'm going to be like this for 2 weeks, you know. But it wasn't that, it lifted. I still was very, very ill, but it wasn't quite that bad the next day. And I suppose that was kind of the first feeling that maybe it's not. And then it was like this rush. I got to get to hospital. It was like completely the other way, you know? Mm. Like, if, I don't know why that was, but it just gave me something to look forward to in a weird way, you know? But that was the darkest, hardest morning of my life, you know? It really was, like, and having someone to turn to was so important, you know. It really was. I just had breakfast with Stephanie again this morning, actually.
Oh, really? And how are you friends with her?
Both of us are always trying to figure that out. We don't really know. I think we met doing the Daily Show one day and we just hit it off. And I think we met a couple of times through work and we just... Like, we've nothing in common. Like, you know, we don't like anything the same. Our politics are completely opposing. You know, we don't like the same music. We have literally not one thing in common that we both like, but we've just become the best of friends. Like, we're just best mates. And neither of us seem to know why that happened. It's just this weird and great relationship. It's kind of like a sitcom, I suppose. Like, there's no reason for us to know each other.
I know. And then as well, loads of people when you came out of hospital were congratulating you, thinking that you were the father of her child.
I know. Yeah, that's kind of, it's so funny. Like, I came out of the hospital because she had a baby and it just dawned on me, like, a year today. It was a year from the day I went in, I think. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I just had this sudden notion. I was like, I'm sitting with Stephanie and her child, and the last time me and Stephanie were in a coffee shop together, like, she was telling me to go to the hospital, and now I felt so good, and she had a new baby, and I Instagrammed a photo of the two of them, and then everyone started going, PJ, you're going to be a great dad. I'm so happy for you. Who would have thought? We didn't even know you were together. I'm like, oh my God, we're not together. And then there was other people saying, I'm so glad you both were in hospital at the same time to pull each other through. I'm like, no, Stephanie's not sick. Stephanie was never sick. You're not reading the story right. And then I went to Stephanie's house after all this, and Noel, the actual father of the child, opened the door and said, hey, congratulations. I was like, yeah, thank you, man.
Yeah. And that is the thing, like, about, I suppose, like, rock bottom moments and life in general, is like, there is such humor in it all at times.
Oh, yeah.
I said to you, like, I didn't want to lose my humor during my cancer journey. I was just like, oh my God, have I just been transported into this world where I'll never be the same again? I'll never laugh the same way again. I'll never find things funny again. Do you think that's a little bit why you were so scared of dealing with what you were dealing with?
That was kind of how I know there's little things that tell you you're not well, you know. And number one, I sing to myself all the time, you know. People talk to themselves, I sing to myself. I don't know what it is. It's like a endless tunes, and like, my head's like a jukebox, and when that stops, I know I'm not feeling great. But then I realized I didn't find anything funny anymore, you know, and this was the slide. And then I got really sick, and then when I was in hospital and I started to feel not sick, you know, I knew I still wasn't well, because I just couldn't participate in conversation, and I couldn't think anything was funny. It was like this huge part of me had been turned off, you know. And I remember thinking, I'm never getting that back. Like, I sat in rooms with psychiatrists, and I was saying, I know this sounds strange, but I can't think anything's funny. Like, nothing's making me laugh. Like, we're having conversations and everyone's laughing, and I'm just sitting there, and I feel like a psychopath. Like, I can replicate it, but it's not real, you know. And they were saying, yeah, just like, and then it gets to a point, they're like, just another couple of weeks. You're like, holy shit, I'm never getting out of it. Like, and that was a big worry. I thought my personality had gone. So I don't feel sick, I don't feel depressed, but my personality's dead. And then we were sitting in the hospital one of the days, and one of the nurses, she told this ridiculous story about a donkey that in Turkey that said ha-he instead of hee-haw. Like, it was the stupidest story. Like, it was so stupid. And I just remember laughing, like, out loud. And I thought, and it dawned on me, like, it's been nearly a year since I laughed like that, you know? And it's gas, actually, since then, so many people have sent me mugs in work with pictures of donkeys and ha-he written on it. Like, I've about, like, 6 ha-he mugs now. It's so ridiculous.
And is it just that one particular donkey, or is it all donkeys?
No, there's a lot of different donkeys, yeah. But it just shows you how nice people are, you know, that they send you these things, like these moments in time. Like, you never think, you just never know when a changing moment is going to come, you know. For me, it was about 12:30 at night, sitting with 2 other patients and listening to a story about a Turkish donkey, you know. It's just, you just don't know when your life's going to change.
I know. And then it's almost in your recovery, you laugh harder than anything you've ever laughed at before. You know, things are funnier when you get better.
Yeah. And you get too comfortable then. So then it was like, I was loving hospital life. Like, this is great. I don't have to think about anything, and everything's really funny. I get on with the other patients so well, and we go for coffee every day, and we have like so much fun. And then they're saying, you're going to get out in 2 weeks. You're like, the hell I am. I'm staying here. I'm too afraid for the real world. Like, this is, you know, you're like, oh shit. Now I feel really good in here. I'm not going back out there again. Like, the last time I was out there, it was horrible.
So at the 4 weeks then, when they said, we want to keep you in, were you okay with that?
Oh, when they, yeah, it got to a stage that I was going to the psychiatrist saying, oh, I hope he gives me another 2 weeks. I hope he gives me another 2 weeks, you know, because I was enjoying it and I was afraid of going back to the real world, you know.
And like when you went in there and over those 11 weeks, like what sort of were you working through, like old trauma? Like what is the day to day work that you're doing in there?
Yeah, for it's not really a lot of that, to be honest, because, you know, when you go in, it's crisis. So, you know, you go to I thought we're going to go to therapy and like they're going to ask me all these questions and I'm not going to be able for this shit. I can't. I'm in such a state. And then you realize the therapist, she just sat me down and goes, right, today we're going to teach you how to breathe again. Like, we're just going to teach you how to breathe. Like, that was it. You have forgotten how to breathe, you know. And I remember thinking, this is ridiculous. But she gave me like 3-4 different breathing exercises. And because you're in hospital, you've all the time in the world. There's no excuse not to do these things, even if you think they're bullshit, you know. And I did 2 of them and I thought, this is bullshit. And then I did this 3rd one because some of the stuff didn't work for me. Different stuff works for different people. So the imagination ones, or you picture yourself in a stream, or you picture yourself, you know, as a color, or those didn't work for me. But then I did this body scan where you just, I know it sounds strange, but you just think of different parts of your body and lie down and breathe. And all of a sudden I was like, holy shit. Like for 5 minutes, I didn't feel sick. You know, for 5 minutes, I was just lying around, you know, for 5 minutes, I was just lying around. And that's a breakthrough. You know, that was a huge breakthrough. And then, you know, meeting someone in the hospital who had the same problems and having them tell you that, oh, when, you know, having them give you stuff to look forward to. So they're like, oh, when you do this, then you're going to get to the next stage and this is going to happen. And then when you hit that target, you're like, oh, you're right. Yeah. You know, and then stupid stuff. I know it sounds so stupid now, but like one of the women saying, one of these days you're going to be playing bingo in here and you're going to win a face cloth and it's going to be the best day of your life. I'm like, I am never going to celebrate a face cloth. I can't even enjoy, you know, real life outside. And then the day I won a face cloth, and I won a face cloth and a toothpaste, and I was like, this is the best day ever. You
know? And just a short break to thank Promise Gluten Free for supporting the Good Glow this season. You know, nutritious food is something that I enjoy every single day. Promise Gluten Free is high in fiber, low in fat, and tastes amazing. Better bread, that's a promise. It's loved in households all over the country, including mine. And here's what one happy customer had to say. Since changing to Promise Gluten Free, my energy levels are much better. I'm less sluggish and I have a better lifestyle. I can now eat decent food with my family. If you are looking for some inspiration, head over to their social media pages for lots of tasty recipes and ideas. You can find them at Promise Gluten Free.
It was kind of funny when I was in there, they asked me to do this exercise where you imagine yourself in what you think is the safest place in the world ever, you know, and I couldn't think of a place to make that exercise work. I just couldn't think of a place. I was able to attach some sort of trauma and terror to everything in my mind that was so unwell. And then since I got out, weirdly, I can do that exercise thinking about my room in the hospital. That's how I do that exercise now. I picture myself in my little room where everyone's looking after me, where all my needs are met, where I know my meal is coming, it's going to be good, where my friends are sitting right outside the door talking to each other, where the garden, I can hear it, I can go there anytime I want. Everybody's around me, you know, I'm never on my own. The Wi-Fi is perfect. I can watch shitty tattoo and cooking shows all day if I want to. And the bingo is starting at 7, you know, and that's my safe place.
Wow, that is unbelievable. And is that service available to everyone? Like if you just make the call, will they get you in somewhere like that?
Well, unfortunately, no, that's not. Like that's the thing. I was really privileged to have health insurance, you know, like if you have any health insurance cover at all, I think the minimum you can get is 100 days. So in a mental hospital. But if you don't have health insurance, it's like I just don't know how people make it, you know, because if I had been more months to wait for me, like when they said I had 2 weeks to wait, I remember thinking this is going to be hard. For people who have to wait months for care and then not have the care that you would get in the likes of St. Pat's, don't know how they get through it, to be honest. Some people, it must be so, so tough, you know. That's, I guess, where you have to try and lean on others. But it isn't available to everyone. It should be, but it's not.
And when you said, like, your biggest fear was people finding out and, I suppose, viewing you differently to how you thought they did, what was that like for you? Was that hard transition?
Weirdly, when you say it once, then you can't shut up about it, you know? Like, weirdly, you know, you're like, don't tell anyone, don't tell anyone, don't tell anyone. And then you suddenly go, okay, I'm going to come out. I'm just telling people where I was. And I went down the pub and told the lads I was in hospital. They all went, oh, no, yeah, we all know, yeah. I was like, right. So then, like, everyone you meet, haven't seen you around. Where were you? I was in the mental hospital. Oh, where are you? Grand. You know, people were just going, you meet lads you went to school with. What's the story? How have you been? Oh, I've been a bit mad lately, you know, but whatever. I just couldn't shut up then. It was a whole new set of rules all of a sudden. It was like a snap. Once you just do it once, you just keep doing it, you know. And I suppose in the hospital as well, it's a totally different set of rules. So in the hospital, if someone comes and sits down next to you and they say hello and you just go, no, and you get up and walk away, nobody gets offended. They just go, oh, well, I understand. It's one of those days. Well, you know, so I guess I'd done that sort of living for 11 weeks. So when you come out, you're practiced in not hiding anymore. You know, you're just practicing saying, nah, I feel shit today. Or you're listening to other people just come in and go, oh, I feel awful today. And then the next day, I feel much better. And everybody's having their own swings, you know.
Yeah. And I love that you said it recently, that Jim turned around to you recently and was like, are you going mental again? And you could just have a laugh about it.
It was so funny because, like, Jim, like I said, he was having such a tough time. And then I had the one day after I came out, because I was on a high after hospital. Like, I'm feeling so good. Like, I got my life back. I have my job back. I'm back on my bikes and I'm back in the pub and I'm back at matches. Life is amazing. And then I had one bad day and I panicked, you know. I was like, oh, shit, this is it again. This is the start. This is the tip of the iceberg. I'm on the slide. I hadn't learned at the time the difference between a bad day and a bad life. And I said to Jim, you know, I'm not feeling great. And he had to put up with so much. And I think he went, ah, Jesus, you're not going mental again, are you? I was like, no. I was like, no, I don't think so. If you've just made me laugh like that, then probably not.
And who makes you laugh in your life? Because I know that you said that your mum had a brilliant sense of humour.
Yeah, yeah. My mum had such a dark sense of humour. She was a very funny woman, you know, when she wanted to be. And like my partner, Kelly, she makes me laugh a lot. Like, and she doesn't even think she's funny, but everything she does is, I think, is hilarious. And, you know, Jim McCabe, I think, is the funniest man that's ever walked the face of the earth. Like, he makes me laugh genuinely every day, you know. So it is kind of my closest friends, really, you know. It's just, I don't know, I find everybody kind of entertaining to their own degree. Like, I find a lot of humor and stuff that people probably don't think is humorous at all. Like, some people say I laugh at everything, but they're the three.
I know you've been so open and you've spoken about it loads of times, and I don't want to bring it up too much, but, like, about your house growing up and... Yeah. What your mum did for other people. Like, when you think about open, tell us a little bit, like, about what that was like for you.
Oh, yeah. It was a HSE experiment at the time. Or not HSE, it was the Eastern Health Board at the time.
Literally an experiment.
Yeah, essentially, yeah, yeah. It was like an experiment where they were going to take people who had been in care their entire lives, try and introduce them back to the community, sort of deinstitutionalize them, I suppose, to some degree. But they were people in our house, six people who were diagnosed with schizophrenia and lived with us and our family in our house, and the dog, my sister, my mom, my dad, and she looked after them and she gave them their medication, their breakfasts, cut their nails, cut their hair, fed them, brought them to mass every Sunday.
Did she?
Like, yeah, like all of that stuff. And, you know, so it was a madhouse, you know, literally a madhouse. And that's why we called the show we wrote about it Madhouse, because I tried to tell these stories in stand-up and no one could relate to it, because, you know, in stand-up you get on stage and you go, I was walking down the road the other day, or I went in for a pint and I was sitting with a friend, and everyone just immediately sees themselves in that situation, you know. But when you say, I came down to the kitchen yesterday and a man was talking to an invisible gorilla that speaks Spanish. You know, when that happens, nobody knows what you're talking about. Like, like nobody can relate to that. So I was there, okay, this is going to need its own show because stand-up isn't going to work.
And, like, obviously then your mum was a big carer of people and adopted you. And did she ever tell you, you know, the stories of that time, or did you ask?
No, she didn't really. And my mom would say anything to make you feel good, you know? Like, so I remember asking her, for instance, like, why did you call me PJ? And she was like, oh, well, we called you PJ. And she goes, because first of all, Patrick, because we're Irish and being Irish is very important to us. And it's an identity that you have. And patron saint of Ireland was Patrick. And then we called you Joseph because in the story of Jesus in the Bible, Joseph was the first father to ever adopt a child. And to show his love that way. So we wanted you to be called Patrick from Ireland and Joseph because of the adopted love of father and everything. And I went to my dad and said, I just heard why I got my name. And he says, what? Why? And I said it to him. And he goes, that's a load of bollocks. You were named after my dad. So she made all this shit up on the spot to try and make me feel good.
Oh my God, I love that. Like, it's so, that is such an Irish mammy thing, isn't it? They'd say anything to make you feel good.
Anything to make you feel good. Anything at all. And then they would tell us none of the details, you know? Like, I was never told I had a sister coming because my sister was adopted too, you know? And so nobody was pregnant or anything. There was no one pregnant in the house. There was no talk of a baby coming. And my dad took me out one day and we came back in and there was just a baby there. And I was like, who's that? He goes, that's your sister. I was like, what? He goes, that's your sister, yeah? Say hello. I'm like, hell yeah. Like, that was it. And then I had a sister. I'm like, this is, you know, it was a different time, I know, but like nobody spoke about anything.
Yeah. Oh my God, PJ, I'm just so glad you're okay. And like, you said 2022 was one of the best years, and yeah. I get what you mean by that, because it's like you broke through, like you're out the other side. Do you look at things differently, or did things just go back to how you were before?
No, nothing went back to the same way. Well, some stuff did, like, But things are totally different. I'm not afraid of being myself at all anymore. You know, like, I'm not afraid of expressing myself anymore. I would always try and, if I was doing interviews or anything, try and tell people what they wanted to hear, you know, try and give a good performance. I just don't do that anymore. Like, I just am myself. And I got back into the things I love with a huge passion. Like, I'm on my bikes every single day again. My kind of new motto was do less, fall behind. Who cares? You know, like, I was always pushing myself so much and so hard on myself, and you're not doing enough, and the gig wasn't good enough, and the show wasn't good enough. Now I'm just like, who cares? Like, literally, who cares? You know, just enjoy your life, you know? So I do a lot of the things I love, and I talk a lot more than I used to, which is probably very tedious for a lot of people. And, you know, I've let my fitness fall off, though. That's unfortunate. That's the only thing that's gone bad. I've never gotten back to my fitness. I'm going to definitely sort that out soon. I've got a lot of depression weight. That's, you know, something like swapping that for what I had last year. That's whatever. Yeah, I'm two sizes bigger than I was. I can live with that. That's fine. You know, I've been living good and really enjoying my life, and that's what's important to me.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting that you say that, like, I haven't got back to the fitness, because I really believe, and it's really a big thing within the Good Glow for me, is that you can kind of only do one thing at a time. And if you overload your plate, like, I'm going to get fit, I'm going to eat healthy, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, yeah, you're never going to do it. You have to do one thing at a time.
Yeah, I so agree with you. I agree with you so much. Like, and when I was at my sickest, my absolute sickest, I was physically the fittest I've ever been, you know, because I was just going through the motions, you know. And I don't know, it'll come. I'm just not going to be hard on myself. It'll come. Like, I'll get back to normal eventually.
When you say, like, oh, the show, I was so hard on myself, and that, like, I feel like I try to be really like that. But how did you get to the point where the work and the things that don't matter? How did you get to the point that they don't matter?
I know it's the answer to everything, but honestly, I think it was having them taken away from me, you know? So I was like, in my head, before I went to hospital, what I would try and do to make myself feel better, I would go, you shouldn't feel depressed. You don't need anything. You know, you have a good job. You've got people around you. You've got a bike. You have every passion you wanted. You've traveled. Like, people would kill to be in your position. What's wrong with you? And then I would suddenly start beating myself up with that, you know? I'd start going like, why aren't you happy? You can't even appreciate the good things. That's how worthless you are. You have it all and you're still doing it, you asshole. What's, you know, it just became this vicious cycle. And then going into hospital and having all that stuff just taken away from me, you know, gone, completely gone. I don't know. It just turned a corner for me, because then when I came out, I was realized it's not about the stuff or the position. It's about being sick or well, you know, it really is. And if you're well, you can appreciate anything, even if that's a 2x8 foot room in a hospital. You can really appreciate it, you know, exactly the same as you can appreciate having your own car or a bike or family around you. Like, you can appreciate it that much, you know. You can literally appreciate anything if you're well. And if you're sick, you can't see the value in anything. So I think you realize it's the sickness. It's not me. It's this lying bastard called depression. And depression is such a liar. And depression is so articulate, you know. It has every argument under the sun to lead you down the bad road. No matter, like, so I'm talking to you now, we've been talking for an hour, and you could come up with every reason under the sun why I should still be alive. But depression has been, for the last 3 months, 24 hours a day, every day, telling me why I shouldn't. So it got there before you, and it's been there longer than you, and it's so hard to turn that voice off, because it's your voice, you know. And then I guess when that's gone, you see things differently, and you want to do things you enjoy, and I mean, it sounds bananas, but the air smells better now, you know. It really sounds ridiculous, but it does, you know.
Yeah, it's Sheila Shoga said that in her recovery from cancer. She's like, everything is brighter. It's like you've put on this other lens and you can see things differently. So I wanted to ask you this question, because I think, like, for so many people, it goes either one way or another. Like, you ask for help and you get better, or the other door is there for you.
Yeah.
How for you was it that door and not the other? What was the thing that saved you?
Well, in the actual moment, it was a text message from Stephanie Preisner. Like, that was the difference. It was, you know, I had everything planned. I knew how I was going to do it. I knew what was going to happen. I saw what was going to happen that day. So in the moment, it was a text message. I know that sounds crazy, but it was a text message. It was like, I just had to get past a certain point in time, I think. That was the only way to get through it. And other than that, I don't have a proper answer other than that it was a text message. So, I mean, in the big picture, I suppose it's having friends who are insistent, and having friends who won't give up on you, and having friends who aren't going to listen to you, lie to them, or like the friends who can see that you're sick and will insist on trying to get the right thing for you or not give up on you. And when I think about how hard it was on them too, like, you know, someone I was with at the time was like ringing helplines themselves because it was so hard coping with me, you know, because they were trying to do everything they could and just realized that they couldn't battle the sickness. All they could do was try and get me into a hospital, you know. So honestly, it came down to a text message. It really did. It was the difference between having my phone charged that day and not. I really think that was what the difference was, you know. When I think of that day and what could have happened to Jesus Christ, it's hard to comprehend now that I was ever in that place, you know.
Yeah, even looking at you, like, you look so well and so happy. It's hard on a human level to look at another person and think that they were like that. But the thing that I wanted to ask you as well is, like, you know, you said that you got that message from Stephanie, and you were so supported around that time. And so many people who go on to take their life would have so much support around them And then they still get to that point. And then I'm sure you hear from people all the time, like friends and family of people that have been left behind, that just feel like they'll never forgive themselves. And that's the wrong thing, because it's no one's fault. But mm-hmm. like, how do they keep going knowing that they didn't get to the person?
There's really nothing you can do, you know. Like, all you can do is your best. All you can do is keep asking, keep insisting, keep hoping, and you can only work with the evidence that's being given back to you by the person, you know. Sometimes the person will say they're fine, you know. Sometimes people will start feeling fine because they've started to plan their way out, you know. That's the unfortunate thing about it. Like, you really can't tell. There's, like, ultimately, unfortunately, it's in the hands of the sick person themselves, you know. So you can only do your best, you know. You really can't look at it and go, I should have done more, I could have done more, if I had just done this, or like, that's just not true. This time the sickness was just stronger, you know. It's awful. Like, it's just awful. But sometimes there's just nothing you can do. And that's not the person who's sick. This person who's sick has probably always got a chance to do something, but like, if they're not listening, they're not listening, you know. It's like trying to ask an alcoholic to stop drinking, or it's like trying to ask, I don't know. I just don't know. It's when you're sick, you're sick. You know, you can't talk someone's out of paralysis. Like, and that is what it feels like, you know?
Yeah. And that's why, though, it's so important for you to speak and use your voice. And I'm sure that when you get like another message from another podcaster to say, will you come on and talk about it? I'm sure you, of course, you want to move on. But like, why do you say yes to doing the interview?
At the start, it was, I'm just going to tell the story once and that's it. I'm never going to talk about it again. That was it, you know. I want to just control the narrative of my own story. So here it is, Late Late Show, going to say, that's it, gone, goodbye. And then it got such a huge response that it kind of shocked me. And then although I knew a lot of people had mental health troubles, I didn't realize so many people were really so mentally ill and not getting help. And so then I initially did the podcast with me and Jim, you know, first, and then I did the Blind Boy one, and like, the response to that has been huge as well. Like, it's just, I just didn't realize so many lads in particular were in such a similar state. And then you get so many like sort of messages on Instagram asking, could you tell the story? Could you do this? And I can't keep up with them. I just can't keep up with them. So I'm pretty selective on who I talk about it all with, because it's not something you can do in a 5-minute interview on the radio. Like, it needs a big conversation, you know. But so I just kind of hope that there's people out there who are like I was one weekend morning, and they might hear something and go, oh, fuck it, I'll get through today and see what happens tomorrow, you know.
Yeah. And that's like, when I text you after I sent you an Instagram message after the Late Late Show, I was like, you've definitely saved a life today. And thank you for taking the time to talk to me on The Good Glow. I could literally sit and talk to you forever and ever. Like, you're just the most amazing person. And before I let you go, I just wanted to ask you what your favorite song is.
My favorite song?
Yeah, like, what gives you, like, what song do you listen to and you just think, you feel alive listening to?
It's been my favourite song since 1989 when it came out. It's Fat Lady Sings, Shine Like an Arc Light. You know that song?
No, sing it.
Oh, you don't know it? Shine like an arc light. No, shine like I want you to shine. Burn like a candle in the sun. It's a great song. I love it so much. Yeah, I love it so much. It's the Fat Lady Sings. They're an Irish band, and they were they're still out there, I think, but that song Arclight, it's great. In fact, I haven't listened to it since I got sick. I'm gonna listen to it now, actually. That's a great song. What a song to think about, actually, now. Yeah, shine on.
Deadly. I'm gonna put that on. I'm driving into town now and I'm gonna put that song on, and I'm going to just be so grateful to you for coming on. And thanks to everyone for listening, and I'll include phone numbers in the episode show notes. Check in with your loved ones, love each other, love yourself. And like you say, PJ, that day was the worst and everything got better from there.
Yeah, yeah, that day was the worst. I mean, if you're really, really, really in that moment, just try and think to yourself, I'll just do one more day, you know? Even if you just wake up every day and just think, I'll just do one more day, then I can absolutely 100% promise you, like, it might be longer than you think and might be more horrible than you think, but the day will come where you'll break it. Like, you will start to get better.
Thank you so much. I cannot thank PJ enough for that conversation. As I said in the intro, please put this podcast in your WhatsApp groups. You just never know who might need to hear that podcast today. The important numbers are in the show notes. And if you can see yourself in PJ's story, please make that call today. Thank you for tuning in to The Good Glow. I hope you're going to enjoy the rest of the season. I've got some amazing guests lined up. And I'll see you tomorrow for the refresh. 10 minutes a day just for you. We've also included some lovely meditations so you have an opportunity to connect with yourself. Please join us over on thegoodglow.ie. And I will say that this course is not just for women. We've lots of men joining us too. Also, my DMs are always open if you need support or help or a guide in the right direction. I am here.